Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. The Taliban has formally confirmed the death of the group's founder, Mullah Omar. An Islamist movement statement Thursday says Omar died of illness but gave no details of when or where, saying only his health deteriorated over the last 15 days of his life. The announcement sheds no new light on whether a statement Wednesday from the Afghan government is correct in saying Omar died 2 years ago. Pakistani statement earlier Thursday said the next round of Afghan peace talks have been postponed at the request of the Afghan Taliban leadership. Pakistan, which hosts the talk, said it remains hopeful the Taliban leadership will stay engaged in the peace process. Investigators are trying to determine whether a piece of airplane debris found on a French Indian Ocean island is part of the Malaysia Airlines jet that mysteriously vanished in March 2014. The approximately 2-meter-long fragment, which appears to be a wing component known as a flapron, was discovered Wednesday on a beach in Reunion Island near Madagascar, more than 3,500 kilometers from where Boeing 777 was last heard from. French aviation officials are examining the material, but say it is too early to determine whether the fragment belongs to the missing flight MH370. The Malaysia Airlines flight, which was carrying 239 people, took off from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, on March 8, 2014, on its way to Beijing. It vanished from radar more than an hour later, somewhere over the South China Sea. Malaysian investigators have said they believe someone deliberately turned off the plane's tracking devices and diverted the aircraft. This is VOA News. The U.S. economy advanced a solid 2.3% in the April to June period after a harsh winter and a small gain. The Commerce Department reported Thursday that a surge in consumer spending and new export gains pushed the world's largest economy ahead in the second quarter. Turkey has declared that its Incirlik airbase is open to U.S. jets to attack the Islamic State militant group. The base, located close to the Syrian border, is seen as crucial by Washington in its battle against jihadists. But a dispute has already broken out between Ankara and Washington on its use. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Ankara's decision to open the Incirlik airbase to U.S. jets was reportedly described as a game-changer by one U.S. official in the battle against Islamic State. Incirlik is located 110 kilometers from the Syrian border, meaning U.S. jets could reach their targets much faster than from locations they've been using. The use of Incirlik by U.S. forces, especially in conflicts with its neighbours, is always a sensitive subject for Turkey, and Turkish governments are very careful about wording terms of use. But analysts say, unless there is a clear agreement on the use of Incirlik, the potential for disputes will remain, warning that Ankara in the past is very skillful in manipulating its use to secure its objectives. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
The British Home Office said Thursday it has granted outspoken Chinese dissident artist Ai Weiwei a full 6-month business visa, despite his earlier claim to have been issued a 20-day entry visa. But the Home Office said that reports Mr. Ai has been refused a visa are incorrect. It said he has been granted a visa to enable him to travel to the UK for the full duration of the stay that he requested. The 57-year-old frequent critic of Beijing has never been formally charged with or convicted of a crime, despite being repeatedly harassed, arrested, and fined by Chinese authorities. An al-Qaeda affiliate abducted an American-trained rebel commander and 7 of his fighters in northern Syria just days after they deployed in the war-torn country. The midweek kidnapping is being seen by analysts as a setback to Washington's effort to shape an insurgent force able to combat Islamic State extremists and is likely to complicate plans for a safe zone in northern Syria, currently under discussion between U.S. and Turkish officials. India executed Yaqub Menon early Thursday for his role in the 1993 Mumbai bombings that killed 257 people. The 57-year-old was hanged at a prison in the western city of Nagpur hours after the country's Supreme Court rejected his final pleas. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
These are ambassadors of countries that have sanctions on us. So we have said we will kick them out of the country.
That's Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe threatening to kick out the British and American ambassadors from his country. Details next.
Also, Major General Ilia Abba has been chosen to lead a multinational force to fight Boko Haram militants in the country's northeast. And Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari has left Cameroon after talks with Cameroon's President Paul Biya.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, the music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe has threatened to expel the ambassadors from the U.S. and Britain, accusing them of fomenting anarchy in his country. Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare.
Late Wednesday, Mr. Mugabe said vendors were resisting calls by authority to leave streets and settle at designated sites. He said the U.S. and British embassies in Zimbabwe were paying vendors to cause chaos in the country.
These are ambassadors of countries that have sanctions on us. So we have said, Vakarambawashidaro, we will kick them out of the country. They don't want to see peace in developing countries. They just want to see chaos, people fighting each other, terrorism everywhere. British and American ambassadors, what sort of people are they? Then they are not good for us. Behave and you will be in peace with us. Misbehave and we'll pick you right from the bottom. It's our country.
Relations between Harare and most Western countries became strained in 2002. That was after the United States and the European Union imposed sanctions on the Mugabe government following allegations of human rights abuses and election rigging. Earlier this month, officials in Zimbabwe summoned the French ambassador to Zimbabwe, Laurent De La Rose, after the diplomat had asked President Robert Mugabe's government to look for an activist who has been missing since March. The activist, Itai Dzamara, disappeared after calling on Mr. Mugabe to step down, saying the president had failed to prop up the economy and respect human rights. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
In a brief statement to VOA's Zimbabwe service, U.S. Ambassador to Zimbabwe, Bruce Wharton, commented about U.S. efforts in Zimbabwe.
Well, as you've seen today, we fund an awful lot of different organizations. Our interests are in supporting economic development in Zimbabwe, social development, health, education. So we support a wide range of projects.
That was U.S. Ambassador to Zimbabwe, Bruce Wharton.
There's beefed up security on the French side of the Channel Tunnel. Authorities report fewer attempts by migrants to force their way into the tunnel to reach asylum in Britain at the other side. They say several hundred people tried to enter the tunnel last night in the French port city of Calais. That compares to 2,300 attempts the night before. Hundreds have been arrested. Some migrants have staged a sit-in to block tunnel traffic in protest. Meanwhile, in Britain, Prime Minister David Cameron is being criticized for the way he's described the situation. He said there's a swarm of people coming across the Mediterranean seeking a better life in Britain. Well, his political opponents say the word swarm should be used for insects and not people. In related news, Italian officials have confirmed the deaths of 14 people on board a boat crowded with refugees this week. More than 450 others on board were rescued Tuesday on the Mediterranean by an Irish naval patrol. So far this year, more than 2,000 migrants and refugees have died while crossing the Mediterranean from North Africa to Europe.
Nigeria has announced who will lead a multinational force to fight Boko Haram militants in the northeast. The French news agency quotes a military spokesman as saying Major General Ilya Abba will take charge. He had previously commanded military operations in the Niger Delta. He also reportedly took part in Niger's peacekeeping contingent in Sudan's Darfur region. The joint force consists of 8,700 troops from Nigeria, Chad, Cameroon, Niger, and Benin. It's expected to begin operation soon. Boko Haram has killed hundreds of people since Nigeria's new president, Muhammadu Buhari, took office in May. But as many as 15,000 may have been killed in Boko Haram's six-year insurgency. Also, Nigeria's Air Force reportedly has seized supplies meant for Boko Haram. A statement says it has intercepted over 4,000 drums and jerry cans of petroleum products and other items.
Well, Nigeria's new president, Muhammadu Buhari, has left Cameroon after a two-day visit that included talks with Cameroon's president, Paul Biya. Moki Edwin Kinziga reports that topics included the Boko Haram insurgency that continues to claim lives.
President Muhammadu Buhari says he will collaborate with Cameroon, Chad and Niger to stop the six-year Boko Haram insurgency in the shortest possible time. Mr. Buhari says there should be trust and confidence among countries that are contributing troops to fight the terrorist group. President Buhari said his visit to Cameroon, which ended Thursday, bolstered support for a multinational army to fight the uprising, and he was optimistic the joint forces will be operational within 30 days.
We cannot afford to falter in our resolve to rid our countries of this evil that is threatening to destroy our hard-earned freedoms and what we have achieved as individual countries and collectively in our sub-region. We recognize that none of us can succeed alone. The federal government of Nigeria is committed to respecting international norms to resolve this matter and to restore normalcy to all affected areas as soon as possible.
The insurgency has claimed at least 60 lives in suicide bombings in Cameroon in recent days. Cameroon's president, Paul Biya, says they, more than ever before, need the support of all countries in stopping Boko Haram.
Le terrorisme est aujourd'hui une menace globale.
He says terrorism is today a global threat that requires a global response, and only a global fight against it can assure the prosperity of our people and guarantee the world of its peace. The violence has displaced about 2 million people and killed 20,000 in Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. Moki Edwin Kinziga for VOA News, Yaoundé.
During U.S. President Barack Obama's recent trip to Ethiopia, he and regional leaders discussed options for restoring peace in South Sudan that included sanctions and a regional intervention if South Sudan's warring parties do not agree a peace deal by August 17th. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi there are differing opinions on whether those options will work.
Meeting Monday with regional leaders in Ethiopia, U.S. President Barack Obama called for a regional intervention force and more sanctions to force both sides in the South Sudan conflict to the negotiating table. Pouok Both Balaung, Director of Information of the Rebel Sudan People's Liberation Movement and Army, SPLM-SPLA, mission in Kenya, told VOA the proposed regional force would not be of much use.
I don't think so that the regional forces can bring peace, because all this, the regional countries, they didn't know the nature of our crisis, our war right now as a South Sudanese. Many countries right now, they're debating about whose side they're taking because they didn't understand the nature or the foundation of that crisis.
Dr. Emmanuel Kisiangani from the Institute for Security Studies, a global think tank, disagrees. He says sanctions and a regional force could indeed bring about peace.
It depends on who constitutes that force. We already have Uganda inside South Sudan, and I'm not sure to what extent the parties will see it as a neutral force. So it depends on who constitutes that. If you have actors who are not siding with any of the parties, I think it can play a role in terms of promoting ceasefire, which is necessary at least to start rebuilding the country and also for peace-building efforts.
Since December 2013, inter-ethnic violence has gripped South Sudan, leaving thousands dead. Regional efforts by IGAD, the East African Regional Bloc, have not led to a cessation of the war. South Sudan's warring factions face sanctions and other measures if a peace agreement is not reached by August the 17th. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe has threatened to expel the ambassadors from the United States and Britain, accusing them of fomenting anarchy in his country. Major General Ilaiah Abba has been chosen to lead a multinational force to fight Boko Haram militants in the country's northeast. And Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari has left Cameroon after talks with Cameroon's President Paul Biya. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Well, new research shows West Nile virus is more dangerous for older people. Their immune system reacts much more slowly to the infection, leaving them more vulnerable than younger people. While the mosquito-borne disease originated in Africa, it's now in the U.S. and other countries. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Not everyone reacts the same to West Nile virus. Dr. Michael Diamond has been studying its effects for years. Most people infected have minor flu-like symptoms, but not so for others.
It's all relative. There certainly are periodic episodic outbreaks that occur annually in the United States and other parts of the world, including Europe, as well as the Middle East and Africa. It's a mosquito-transmitted disease, and in a subset of people who are either immunocompromised or elderly or very young or have other conditions, you can get severe neuroinvasive disease. And sometimes, unfortunately, that can result in long-term neurologic impairment or even death.
Diamond is professor of medicine, molecular microbiology, pathology, and immunology at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. He and his colleagues and researchers at other institutions have been studying immune response in the elderly.
Together, we've been interested in identifying what happens to the immune system as you age and why doesn't it work as well. Not only are you susceptible to West Nile virus infection, but you're susceptible to many infections, including influenza, for example, is worse in the elderly or other viral infections. In addition to that, elderly people don't respond to vaccines well. Every year they get a vaccine, but the effectiveness of that vaccine is much, much decreased in the elderly as well.
The study, published in PLOS Pathogens, is based on research done with mice. In the lab, a 4-month-old mouse is equivalent to a young adult, while an 18-month-old mouse is elderly.
We have a mouse model of West Nile virus infection that looks very much like humans. It's not equal to humans, but it looks like humans in this respect. Young mice are relatively resistant, and as they age, they become much more susceptible to it, and they can die from it or they can get severe neurologic disease in parallel.
Diamond says they concentrated on sentinel cells, or naive CD4 T cells. They travel through the body and look for potential threats, like bacteria or viruses. They coordinate the immune response. CD4 T cells are the same cells targeted by HIV, the AIDS virus. West Nile virus does not attack those cells. It infects the skin and then goes on to the draining lymph nodes.
One of the earliest defects was that these naive CD4 T cells, which are sentinel cells, which are key to starting parts of the immune response, get to the lymph node much more slowly than in a normal adult animal. Even once they're in the lymph node, they don't move as quickly. So they have two defects, and because of this, they're less able to find the virus, if you will, and that delays the period of time between when you get infected to when your immune system really gets started.
That delay, even a few days, can mean the difference between a mild infection and one that goes to the brain.
Once it's in the brain, then it's a problem. Then you have to clear it. And even if you clear it, there's after effects of having a virus and having the immune system in the brain.
It's not known yet why the naive CD4 T cells have defects in older mice and theoretically in older people. That's one of the things Diamond and the others are trying to find out. He says there are many, many possible answers. When the reason is found, it could lead to treatments to boost the immune systems in older people. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Uganda's parliament passed a law this week that brings the country into line with the most stringent tobacco control policies around the world. The groundbreaking law will introduce some of the toughest restrictions on the distribution, sale, and use of tobacco products. The International Union Against Tuberculosis and Lung Disease has been a supporter of Uganda's Ministry of Health. It's been working since 2012 on a national strategic plan for tobacco control. Dr. Essen Lotef is Director of Tobacco Control at the International Union Against Tuberculosis and Lung Disease. He explained what this law means for Uganda's smokers and non-smokers.
It's a very strong law which the Ugandan government has passed. It encompasses all the demand-side procedures and efforts. So it encompasses 100% smoke-free public places. It also takes into account a 100% ban on advertising, promotion, and sponsorship. And they also have banned the display of cigarette packs at the point of sale. So if you compare it with some of the strongest laws out there, it really serves to control tobacco control in Uganda. But one of the good things that they have done is that they have also taken into account the industry and its interference with the public health policies. So they are also talking about the Article 5.3 of the FCTC, that's the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, where the industry is kept away from public health policy and they are not allowed to interfere. And they also talk about the creation of a National Tobacco Control Committee. And we are very happy to note that it will be chaired by the Prime Minister, because then it gives you the right political commitment and power behind the committee to legislate even further tobacco control measures.
Given these more stringent restrictions placed on the tobacco industry, how do you think they will respond to this law?
Oh, they will respond as they do globally. You know, they will come against the Ministry of Health in Uganda, they will file cases. But if the Ugandan government keeps it as the health of the people as their priority, then they should be able to defend it, because it's not about the economy, it's not about how much profits the industry can earn, it's about the health of the people and how to protect it. But they have been trying all different tactics to delay this law. If you go into the history of the development of this law, it has taken some years and it was delayed at every stage. But the health took priority, and we are very happy that this law is now in force.
How confident are you that this law will be enforced?
Look, enforcement has its challenges. In low and middle income countries, you need to provide them with the infrastructure. But the first step has been done. That is that the law is in place. Now, sub-laws and rules will be formulated and enforcement mechanisms would be put in place. We will continue to provide them with technical assistance on how to do it, share our experiences on how it is done in other countries. If countries like the other countries who have done it, for example, in Russia, when they introduced their law, they saw it drop from 34% in 2008 to 28% in 2013. Other countries have also done it. So enforcement, yes, I agree, is a challenge. But given the right technical assistance, given the right measures, Uganda should be able to do it. It is going to be slow. You will not see an overnight change, but it will happen.
What is the present state of tobacco use in Africa?
Just give you an example. The tobacco use in all the other countries, for example, in Western Europe, it dropped by 26% between 1990 and 2009, but increased in the Middle East and Africa by 57% during the same period. So while all the other regions who are introducing more stringent laws have been on tobacco control and are slightly ahead in terms of the time frames, they are seeing a drop. But Africa, which is just beginning to legislate on tobacco control, is still experiencing a rise. And every time you see, you look at these tobacco industry tactics, they aim for the young and the young adults. So most of the people in Uganda take up smoking when they are teenagers or are below the age of 20. So again, if Uganda has banned these tobacco advertising promotion and sponsorships, you will start seeing an effect on the consumption of smoking in Uganda.
Are Ugandan teenagers, are they aware of the dangers of smoking?
They are. And if they are using bigger and better graphic health warnings, everybody who buys a pack will see those graphic health warnings. And that's the best message you can get out there. Media campaigns are expensive, and it's difficult for low and middle income countries to sustain them. But having bigger, better graphic health warnings, or even plain packaging or generic packaging as was introduced by Australia, is the best way of introducing this health awareness messages into the public, especially the smokers and even those who are trying to start smoking.
That was Dr. Essen Latif. He's Director of Tobacco Control at the International Union Against Tuberculosis and Lung Disease. He spoke with me from London.
If climate change is left unchecked, scientists say there will be a dramatic increase in the number of children suffering from malnutrition. It's currently the third leading cause of death of youngsters worldwide. As VOA's Jessica Berman explains, extreme weather conditions are predicted to wipe out crops that are the main source of nutrition for billions.
There are 7 million malnourished children under the age of 5 worldwide, according to the World Health Organization. Of these, one-third die either from the direct effects of starvation or from infectious diseases that stalk the very young, weakened by lack of food. The highest proportion of these children lives in the developing world. Scientists like Ravati Falki predict the lives of millions more children will be put at risk in the future due to hunger and a lack of nutrients tied to climate change.
What we are trying to say is that climate change in the next, by 2050, is going to add additional 25 million children who are going to be undernourished, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia.
Falki is a public health expert at the University of Heidelberg, Germany. She co-authored an article published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, systematically reviewing 15 papers that looked at the impact of global climate change on nutrition. 80% of the studies concluded that extreme weather conditions will destroy crops that are the primary source of sustenance for young children worldwide. Falki's colleague, Rainer Sauerborn, is senior author of the PNAS article.
We will have more extreme weather events. We will have torrential rainfalls. We will have droughts. We will have shifts in seasonalities, for example, later beginning of the rainy season, then stopping of rainfalls. And all this, our colleagues from agriculture tell us, is reducing the crop yields.
Sauerborn and Falki spoke from Burkina Faso, the West African country with one of the world's highest incidents of child malnutrition.
We are trying to put the health argument in the center and saying, look, people care about koala bears and about ice bears, but most people care much more about their children and their malnourished children and about disease of grandchildren and grand-grandchildren, because they are going to suffer from this.
International talks aimed at an agreement to slow the rate of greenhouse gas emissions and hence the pace of climate change are scheduled to take place in Paris at the end of the year. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. We'll be right back.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe threatens to expel the ambassadors from the U.S. and Britain, accusing them of fomenting anarchy in his country. Major General Ilia Abba has been chosen to lead a multinational force to fight Boko Haram militants in the country's northeast. And Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari has left Cameroon after talks with Cameroon's President Paul Biya. Coming up, we'll have music from South Africa and in our feature segment, putting an end to people profiting from Africa's violent conflicts. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday, Kim. And sporty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. Joining us once again on the Sunny Side of Sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, the preliminary draw for the 2018 World Cup football tournament has been held in St. Petersburg, Russia. Let's take a look at how the African teams fared in the draw. And let's begin with the first round, David. How does that look?
13 matches, and these are between the lower-ranked countries in Africa. The first one, Somalia against Niger. I always salute Somalia because it's a war-torn country, and yet they do find the courage to compete in this competition. The sad side of it, Sunny, is that they will not be able to play at home in Mogadishu. In the last competition, we saw Somali side in. It was the Olympic Games. They played a home match in Djibouti, neighboring Djibouti, and that could well be the case again. Niger, I fancy, will win this tie, partly because of that fact that Somalia will not be able to utilize home advantage. The next match between South Sudan and Mauritania is interesting because it will mark the debut of South Sudan. I think Mauritania are improving, and I fancy them to win this tie. An interesting one between Gambia and Namibia. Gambia recently came to South Africa, to Durban, and it's forced a 0-0 draw with Bafana Bafana. And on the basis of that, I give them a slight edge over the Namibians. The next one is Sao Tome and Principe against Ethiopia. My tip there, Ethiopia. Chad against Sierra Leone. Two reasonably talented countries from West Africa. Slight preference for Chad. And here again, Sunny, unfortunately, an issue of home advantage. Because of the Ebola epidemic, Sierra Leone will have to find a neutral venue for their home leg. Comores against Lesotho is a Southern African derby. Lesotho are my fancy. Djibouti against Swaziland. Well, Djibouti are the weakest country in terms of rankings in Africa. Swaziland recently had a good win over Guinea in the Africa Cup of Nations, and therefore I give the Swazis the vote. Eritrea against Botswana is interesting in the sense that Eritrea very seldom play international football. The problem there, Sunny, is every time the Eritreans go abroad, most of their team abscond and seek political asylum, and that is because of the oppressive regime in Asmara. So there'll be sort of sporting and news interest in that tie, in which Botswana should emerge victorious. Seychelles against Burundi. My tip is Burundi. Liberia against Guinea-Bissau. Now, we spoke about the fact that Sierra Leone and Somalia will not be able to play at home in their ties. The good news for the Liberians is, despite the fact that they've only recently come out of their Ebola epidemic crisis, they will be able to play in Monrovia. And that could well prove decisive in favor of the Liberians. Central African Republic against Madagascar. The Central African Republic, they haven't been doing particularly well of late. Madagascar impressed in the CASAFA Cup. I fancy the Malagasy side to go through to the second round. We've got a lot of listeners up there in Kenya, where President Barack Obama has very recently been on a visit.
Hello, everybody.
The good news for Kenyans is this is a tie they should win. The last tie, Sunny, in the first round is between Tanzania and Malawi, an interesting one, an intriguing one, with perhaps the Malawian Flames having a slight advantage over the Tanzanian Taifa Stars. And both legs, Sunny, will be played this October in this first round of the World Cup.
Let's turn to the second round, David, where some of the big boys of Africa come into play. How does that look?
Yes, Sonny, you mentioned the big boys, and the very first tie is Somalia or Niger versus Cameroon. Now, Cameroon are the record 7-time qualifiers from Africa for the World Cup. No African country has done as well as the indomitable Lions of Cameroon. And you would certainly have to fancy them to win this tie. Another big gun, Sonny, are Tunisia, and they will start against South Sudan and Mauritania. And really, my prediction, it's ditto. It's the big boys to succeed in this case, Tunisia. Gambia or Namibia against Guinea, Sao Tome or Ethiopia against Congo, Brazzaville, Chad or Sierra Leone against Egypt. Now, Egypt are an interesting case. They do extremely well in the Africa Cup of Nations. They've won that competition a record 7 times. But when it comes to the World Cup, the Pharaohs consistently struggle. They've only played in the World Cup twice. The first time was way back in 1934 when they didn't actually qualify. They were just invited. In those days, Sonny, you had no active, organized football going on in Africa. So Egypt really looking to try and amend this poor record of theirs. The other time that they did qualify was 1990, and they did actually quite okay. But since then, repeatedly winning the Africa Cup of Nations, but repeatedly flopping at the World Cup. So Egypt are going to be rather wary when they start off against Chad or Sierra Leone. The Comores or Lesotho will play Ghana. Ghana will be going for a 4th consecutive World Cup appearance. They were there in Germany in 2006, in South Africa in 2010, and then Brazil in 2014. And it would be a sensation if the Black Stars failed to qualify for the 3rd round. Good evening to all our Nigerian listeners. And their first match is against Djibouti or Swaziland. And as I said with the previous tie, Sonny, it really would be a turn up for the books if the Nigerians did not get through that tie. They're going to be too strong, and I fancy the team they will play is going to be Swaziland. Eritrea or Botswana will play Mali. Seychelles or Burundi will play the Democratic Republic of Congo. Liberia or Guinea-Bissau up against the African champions, Ivory Coast. A West African derby, no matter who emerges victorious from the first round tie, but the Ivorians surely will prove too strong in the 2nd round tie. Central African Republic or Madagascar against Senegal. Senegal, quarter-finalists in the World Cup in 2002, but they have not been back since, so they've got a lot to play for and a lot to prove. Mauritius or Kenya will play the Cape Verde Islands. Tanzania or Malawi will play Algeria. And then, Sonny, you have some ties that are already decided in the sense it's one against one. They are Sudan against Zambia, Libya against Rwanda, Morocco against Equatorial Guinea, Mozambique against Gabon, Benin against Burkina Faso, Togo against Uganda. Now, Sonny, your colleague Douglas, the stories we're hearing here in Africa, is that he has not been well since the World Cup draw was made. I mentioned to Douglas that in the recent Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers, the Togolese beat Uganda in Lome and in Kampala. So, Douglas, the best of luck to you and to the Ugandan Cranes. And the last tie, Sonny, is the one that really stands out for me in the 2nd round. It's the only tie between 2 countries that have qualified for the World Cup. It's the Palancas Negras, the Sable Antelopes of Angola, up against Bafana Bafana of South Africa.
Arise and shine, Bafana Bafana, arise and shine. Let your victory be enshrined in the great annals of soccer. Tackle them and leave them dizzy. Tackle them and leave them mesmerized. Shine, Bafana Bafana, shine. Hola, Bafana Bafana. Hola, Bafana Bafana. Bafana Bafana. Bafana Bafana.
Now, South Africa have got a good record against Angola down the years. 5 victories and 3 draws, no losses. But this is a tough one, Sonny. And we have to bear in mind that if South Africa slip up in this tie, they will be out of the running for the 2018 World Cup in Russia. So there's an awful lot to play for. It's a Southern African derby, and certainly that's one we're going to keep a keen eye on in the coming weeks on the Sunny Side of Sport. Both legs, Sunny, will be played in November, and the 22nd round winners, they will go into a separate draw. Those 20 countries will be split into five groups of four, and those five group winners, they will go to Russia to represent Africa in 2018 at the World Cup.
David, in terms of those five groups of four, will the top-seeded teams be based on the FIFA rankings?
I expect so, Sonny. But obviously it won't be the rankings of July, which decided the first and second round. You'll have fresh rankings. So there's an awful lot to play for the countries, because you take South Africa at the moment, they're only going to be a fourth seed because they are ranked 16th in Africa. So if we, you and I, Sonny, were to make that draw tomorrow, South Africa would be one of the bottom seeds. And that's not what they want to be, because that means they could, for example, get Ivory Coast, they could get Egypt or Nigeria. It would be an extremely tough group. But yes, I expect the seedings, and I think the seedings is a fair way to go about it. That's what they've used for the first and second rounds. VOA!
David, if our VOA listeners have a football-related question for you, can you give us your email address?
Yes, certainly, Sonny. It's david.legge, and leg is spelled L-E-G-G-E, at AFP, that's Agence France-Presse.com. So I'll just repeat that one more time. It's david.legge, L-E-G-G-E, at AFP.com. And we'd love to hear from you.
Voice of America.
The Sunny Side of Sports welcomes your comments. You can send me email at sunny@voanews.com. Sunny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237. Follow The Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is at VOA Sunny Sports. I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's The Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sunny, and listen to The Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of The Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, the dramatic decline in the value of the Ugandan shilling. And next, putting an end to people profiting from Africa's violent conflicts. But first, some music. Here is Jovan Chaka Chaka from South Africa with The Power of Africa.
Yeah.
Yvonne Chaka Chaka from South Africa with the Power of Africa.
Well, the past few months have seen a dramatic decline in the value of the Ugandan shilling. This fall has caused a spike in rents and a drop in salaries across the nation, with many wondering when will it end. Elizabeth Pala has more from Kampala.
This past month, the Ugandan shilling dropped to historic lows. Vendors who pay their rent in U.S. dollars have seen a sharp spike in costs, while some healthcare clinics have started setting their prices in dollars. There are a number of factors that have caused the shilling to fall, including a stronger U.S. economy and a drop in exports to war-ravaged South Sudan. Bank of Uganda Research Director James Opelot says falling commodity prices have also hurt because most of the country's exports are commodities. Although the shilling remains low, it has stabilized somewhat due to intervention from the Bank of Uganda. Many officials blame the sharp drop on sensationalistic stories in the media that said the bank would no longer intervene in the market. Bank of Uganda Communications Director Christina Lupo says that's not true, but adds the bank does not and cannot intervene all the time.
And that has been our standard message throughout. Our message has always been that our interventions when there is excessive volatility and we are trying to restore stability to the market. And we have judged that some of the movement is by factors that are not necessarily fundamentals.
But a weak shilling has made life difficult for foreign workers. Jenny Smith says that with a family to feed, it has been frustrating.
Well, my salary is effectively $100 less a month than it was. So there's that. And like all the prices have also increased recently, of the price of shopping, like anything in supermarkets, it's not a huge amount, but it has gone up. So having a combination of less money and then higher expenses, you know, you can't make the ends meet quite as well as they were before, and it feels like it's only going to get worse the closer we get to the election.
Although many are blaming the upcoming elections for the drop, banking officials say that if people stay calm and continue to invest normally, the situation should stabilize. But those who are struggling to stay afloat in the current conditions say their time is running out. Elizabeth Pala for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
The Washington-based Enough Project says it wants to put an end to people profiting from Africa's violent conflicts. The nonprofit group has launched a new initiative called The Sentry, which it says will work to eliminate violent conflicts by stopping the companies and individuals who are making money from those conflicts. Reporter Ian Bior has the story.
Africa loses a whopping $50 billion or more each year to illicit economies, according to the United Nations Economic Commission on Africa. The commission says that number actually exceeds the amount Africa receives in development funds by about $4 billion. Akshaya Kumar, a policy analyst at the Enough Project, says part of the work of the Sentry Initiative is to trace the complicated web of money that fuels conflicts like the one in South Sudan.
A lot of effort has already gone into trying to mediate peace between President Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar. But until now, there hasn't been a really detailed financial investigation into those who are funding and fueling this war.
Kumar says policymakers around the world typically lack credible research and evidence to make their case against those who make their livelihood off the pain and suffering of people caught up in violent conflicts.
Our hope is that with this initiative, policymakers and those who are working on the peace process will be better equipped to construct the leverage that's really necessary to fight the continued intransigence of both warring parties in South Sudan, and also that they'll be able to tackle the enablers and the financiers who are enabling both sides to continue fighting on.
Under this new initiative, Kumar says even those who made illegal gains off conflicts in the past, including those in southern Sudan, will be investigated.
Well, what the Sentry seeks to do is the really detailed investigative work to identify where people have hidden their stolen assets, to identify how the different warring sides are buying their weapons, to look into how so many billions of dollars were stolen from South Sudan and even before then from southern Sudan following the signing of the CPA until today.
Kumar says the Sentry will then take all that information, package it, and use laws already on the books to expose money launderers, wildlife poachers, and other criminals to authorities. The Century's new report points to figures from 2014 indicating the projected oil revenue for South Sudan that year was roughly 12.8 billion South Sudanese pounds, or about $4.3 billion. That nearly equals the funds allegedly stolen in 2012. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Jackson Nvunganyi, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
4 years ago this month, South Sudan celebrated its independence with much jubilation and great hope that a split from the North would finally put an end to decades of civil war. That, unfortunately, was not to be. The relative peace that followed lasted all of 18 months. In December 2013, a political schism evolved into widespread conflict that, in part, devolved along ethnic lines. The conflict is remarkable in its brutality against civilians. This has been stated in a number of reports from NGOs and the United Nations that take note of human rights violations and abuses committed by both sides. They range from ethnically motivated murders to gang rapes and the mass destruction and looting of civilian property. Thousands have been killed, 2.4 million have been displaced, and almost 4.6 million are in need of humanitarian aid. On June 27th, the United States urged the United Nations Security Council to blacklist six rival commanders from South Sudan for threatening that country's peace and stability. On the government side, they are Major General Mario Changwang Yaw Mangwak, Lieutenant General Gabriel Jok Riak, and Major General Santino Dengwal. Rebel leaders to be sanctioned are Major Generals Simon Gatwich Dual, James Koang Chual, and Peter Gadet. In a July 1st vote, the Security Council agreed. All six had previously been sanctioned by our Treasury Department regarding their financial transactions. South Sudan's political leadership has squandered the international goodwill that accompanied its independence and pursued political and economic self-interest that has produced only violence, displacement, and suffering for the South Sudanese people, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations Samantha Power. Political and military leaders on all sides of this conflict must put aside their self-serving ambitions, end the fighting, and engage in negotiations to establish a transitional government.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials. We'll be right back.
Africa.